Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and I am joined today in the studio live with women in federal law enforcement. For many of you who are out there in federal law enforcement, you know them as WIFL. I'll probably alternate today between WIFL and women in federal law enforcement. And we have with us, we always have with us, Margie Moore, who is the executive director of WIFL. Good morning, Margie.
Good morning, Deborah.
Same time this year. We always bring WIFL back into our radio show, Fed Talk, every year around this time, to help Margie and WIFL promote their annual conference, which we're going to spend a good deal of the show talking about. And we are also very fortunate to have with us today in the studio the president of the executive committee of WIFL, Mary Cooper. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Deborah.
Thank you for coming into the studio today and being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's your maiden journey. Are you allowed to say what agency you work at?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Mary's at, I don't want the ethics monitors over there at the department. I don't want to get you in trouble with them. Mary's at DEA, which is a very cool place to be in federal law enforcement. And she's also the president of the executive committee of WIFL, right?
That's correct.
And she's going to be one of their keynote speakers at the conference. So we're very excited to have Mary with us today and tell us a little bit about why she joined WIFL and what she's going to contribute to the conference. For those of you who are listening, you know that our show is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes can save you 15% on car insurance. Everybody knows GEICO's website, but we give it out anyway. It's geico.com. If you have a question or a comment for Margie and Mary, either one, give us a call. It's toll-free. We're at 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us if you're feeling shy this morning. You can email your question to fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. So Margie, like I said, it's same time this year. You come back every year to promote the conference. This year, I think it's called the 11th. You're in your 11th conference.
Yes, right? I can't believe it.
The 11th Annual Leadership and Training Conference. And like always, you just put on this agenda that's mind-boggling about not just the topics, but the talent that you get to come to the conference is always, it's just sort of like eye-opening. Like, how do you get those people? But we're going to talk about that later in the show. For people who are listening and they want to learn more about WIFL, you can also go to their website, WIFL.org. They have a fascinating history, WIFL, about how they got started. Margie, you were there at the beginning. It's always fun to hear the story.
I always say one of the founding mothers.
Founding mothers, right. Tell us a little bit about the beginnings of WIFL, how it got started, the inspiration.
Well, WIFL now is a nonprofit, and that's why we're talking about our 11th annual leadership training. Historically, it started back in the late 70s, early 80s as an interagency committee between Departments of Treasury and Justice. And that was because in 1972, President Nixon signed this executive order that said you have to allow women to participate fully and equally in all federal jobs. And therefore, the barrier that existed that did not allow women to carry firearms in the federal government was lifted, and they started hiring their first women.
And I always think it's great to come back to that fact that Margie sort of puts out there, but women weren't allowed to carry firearms
in the federal government. That's correct. So therefore, they were prohibited from becoming sworn officers.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's ancient history, but it was very real during that time. And we're so glad that women today don't even remember that, Because it's not an
obstacle. Because we're old, and most people who are in our, most people who are there, they're like, you know, young. They were born in 72. Yes. And of course, the 72 executive order by President Nixon was the sort of implementation of the Civil Rights Act, the anti-employment.
That's correct.
Anti-discrimination in Employment Act that passed Congress in 1972. And then the president applied it to employment in the federal government.
Yeah, it's part
of the
Civil Rights Act. Exactly.
Yeah. So tell us, it was the interagency committee. It had a name.
It was called WIFL, Women in Federal Law Enforcement. And that has carried over. It obviously has great name recognition amongst all the federal agencies. But the purpose of that committee was to look at what was, at that time, no women, and how do we start recruiting women into these federal law enforcement positions.
In the early 70s?
In the early 70s and the 80s. I came on ATF in 1976, and I was the third woman that they hired at the time. So when you go back, you look at the first women that were hired was Secret Service, FBI, at the time INS, NDEA. So some of the first women were being hired in 1972. But very, you know, the first woman ATF was in 1972. I was the third woman in 1976. So it wasn't like we were coming on in droves.
Yeah. And, you know, the reality was society, women, it wasn't something that they thought was available to them.
Correct.
So it was about sort of changing society's mindset about what jobs you could do.
Yes. Which brings us to today when we're looking at women in federal law enforcement. The latest survey completed by the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Statistics, 2004, 16%.
This is a 2004?
Well, that's the latest one. We're waiting anxiously because they're coming to our conference to present the very latest figures on whether or not women minorities have increased, decreased. So in 2004, we represented 16% of the overall population of the sworn women. There are 105,000 sworn federal agents.
Okay, so
in 2004,
when you say sworn agents, you said 105,000?
Yeah, 105,000. Those who carry firearms have arrest authority.
Okay, so for our listeners, you know that's the 1811s out there.
1811s, 1810s. There's a host of different sworn positions.
Okay,
so of 105,000. 16% are women.
16%. That was as of 2004?
Four. So now we want to see what is going on because anecdotally, we hear information that agencies are having a tough time recruiting. In fact, we can talk about our recruitment day that we're having. So they want to know, how do we recruit women? I don't think it's a matter of how you recruit women because women are motivated by the same factors as men. It's a good job. This is a good job.
Well, it's also a calling.
Yes.
It's not just, you know, it's a good job, it's interesting, it's exciting, it has good benefits. When you know people, I'm very fortunate to be, you know, my job takes me into the federal community, and I know a lot of federal law enforcement officers and men and women of all races. And it's a calling. I mean, people call, it's a call to serving, you know, to serve.
Yes.
And women feel that as strongly as men.
Oh, absolutely. Women are just as patriotic. And since 9/11, of course, there have been a lot of people who want to get into the federal service.
So you say you don't think it's about recruiting? What did you say?
Well, when you advertise these jobs, agencies have to advertise also that they're the employer of choice, that they have the policies in place that can support you as a young individual coming on, like, say, 25 years of age, through all of the life changes that you will go through for the next 25, 30 years, you know, marriage, children, elder care, divorce, sickness, moving, travel. And that has to be in place. And with women in particular, it's pregnancy. And a lot of the federal agencies rely on the FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act. But when it comes to pregnancy, I think agencies really have to reexamine their policies and look at how do you handle the needs of a pregnant woman, and it should be a routine event, not something that just throws the agency, you know, and says, oh my God, you know. You have to really have concrete policies in place that carry that individual basically for the 6 months that's most critical, the second and third trimester during her pregnancy.
Yeah, no, and you know, I've represented women agents, and it's amazing when you say an actual policy in place, because some agencies have a very, it's very drawn out, and other agencies it's like a surprise. She's, what are we going to do? She's pregnant. And last year you spoke about pregnancy and you came here and talked about it, and it was really fascinating. I can't say I was skeptical, but I was curious how the federal agencies could get, I don't want to say around, but how do you deal? You can't send a woman who's 9 months pregnant out, you know, on a raid.
No, and I think the agencies do accommodate women, but it's not in writing. And I think they've been very good mm-hmm. at looking at different situations.
But you're saying it would help if women coming yes. in could see something in black and white and know
correct.
That as I, you know, evolve through my life, this employer is yes. going to have a process to deal with it.
In place that is making this routine.
Mm, that's very interesting. Yes. And like I said, last year we did pregnancy in federal law enforcement. It was really interesting. You have some great, very interesting, different topics this year at the conference. We're going to talk about some of them, but we do need to take our first break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. By now, you've no doubt seen those car insurance commercials with the talking gecko on TV. He's always talking about how people could save 15% or more switching to GEICO. Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal in and of itself. But get this. If you're an employee of the federal government, you may be eligible to save even more than that. That's something the GEICO didn't mention in all those commercials. And you've probably heard many times about how many people have switched to GEICO. Millions. But what you might not know is how many people stay with GEICO once they've switched. In fact, on average, GEICO customers who are federal employees have stayed with the company for over 20 years. Now that's customer satisfaction. Sound like a good deal to you? Then just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and in the studio with me today is Margie Moore and Mary Cooper, both of Women in Federal Law Enforcement. We're going to be talking with Mary and Margie for the rest of the 11 o'clock hour about WIFL and their upcoming conference that is in Atlanta, everybody, this year, not Tennessee. If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free, 1-877-936-9333. Or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. So, Mary, like I said, this is your maiden voyage to our show. We're very excited to have you here. And, you know, I always think it's, we have a lot of federal employee associations on Fed Talk that are here to talk about the things that are important to their constituency, get the word out, try to get people involved. And so I always think it's important for people who come from these associations to explain to our listeners, why'd you get involved in the association you're now here representing? And so that would be my first question to you, Mary.
Several years ago, I attended WIFL, but I hadn't known Margie. I attended and I got away from it. You know, you get caught up going, working a lot and doing different things. And I had met Margie, I think it was a few years ago, about three in Palm Springs. She asked me to sit in on a panel. And I think at that time, I started to see this huge conference only had several people really behind it doing the work.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's amazing.
It's amazing, but unfair.
Yes. It's behind the curtain. You saw Margie and a few people doing it. And then she had me on the panel, and then I started to take the time and look and say, look, it's time that I give back and help Margie. And I think it just evolved into helping her more. Last year, I was a secretary. And this year, the president, and it was time. And I think it's important. You have so many different things going on, but you have to stop. You have to make it a priority. And that's what I've done. And I'm glad I've done it.
And you know, we didn't explain to our listeners what, you know, it's Women in Federal Law Enforcement, and you sort of think that it self-explains. The name of the organization self-explains what WIFL's about. But when you... You know, I guess it's worth saying that when, you know, Margie has a value statement, a mission statement, a goal statement, and essentially it's about promoting gender equity throughout federal law enforcement. And I imagine that vision, Mary, must have spoken to you and got you, you know, in addition to just liking Margie, who wouldn't, right? People are very drawn. She's, you know, she's very inspired by the organization. But it, you know, it has this altruistic vision of what it wants to accomplish.
It does. And I think it comes down to women helping women. And I think it's needed. I think we get caught up in everything we're doing. And I think it's time to give back the wisdom or the things we've learned. Like, for example, I'll be giving a speech at the conference. And I think a lot of it is lessons I've learned. Maybe I learned them 6 months ago. I might have learned them 10 years ago. But it's to give, you know, to help people about having diversity in your career, about the importance of being a mentor, taking time to giving back, mm-hmm. you know, about passion in your career and things like that.
And tell us a little bit, because you are giving one of the keynotes, tell us a little bit, give us a little a taste of what some of the things are you're going to talk about.
I think one of the most important things is seizing opportunities, and which allows you to have diversity in your career. And I see so many good, talented women in the organizations, but they're a little timid. They're a little timid of maybe taking that. And that's my job or my role to say, no, take the, you know, it's usually take the risk. It's usually when you don't want to is when you should. And I've seen that difference between men and women, where men will take it with great confidence, and women, though they are capable, you know, need that little push. And that's what I hope to do in my role in WIFL, to help out.
Sort of get women thinking about the things that are that sort of operate on us subconsciously in the workplace. And if Margie's statistic, which is from 2004, and it's not Margie's statistics, Department of Justice statistic from 2004, that says there's 16,000 women, that's like for... It's 16 of every 100 in your organization are women. So it might be a little harder, though, Mary, to find a mentor or, you know, or find another woman to sort of help you work through the issues that you want to focus on to advance your career. Isn't that part of, how does a woman deal with that in the workplace? The pool's limited.
I think having mentors, you can have men as well. And a lot of my mentors have been men. It's whoever. And when you seize the opportunities, you tend to find your mentors. And when you have your mentors, the ones I've had for 26 years with DEA, that I still call for advice. And it doesn't matter if it's male or female, but those are the people that are going to help you. And then as you rise up, say, to where I am right now, it's my responsibility to help other women. I mean, I'm proud I can sit here and say I helped women get spots in Paris, Rome, Brussels, some of the best spots of DEA, because I take it as a responsibility. And you kind of have to teach that to other women at the conference, that that's the important thing to do.
Yeah. And, you know, men got this, they get this rap. It's, you still hear it out there. It's not just in the federal government. You hear it out in corporate America. They call it the boys club or the old boys club. And it's really sort of very much, Mary, like what you're talking about. It's about a perception that the men are, you know, there's one level or generation of men reaching down and helping, taking care of the next one up. But it's usually, you say it in a negative way, that somehow it's cutting out other people. The flip side of the coin, the more positive or favorable view, is that it is sort of embedded in their social structure that they're helping one another out. You know, women used to be in the 80s, the view was that women, other women who you worked with, were like your enemy because you were in competition with them.
And that's what I think you have to teach, or you have to tell them. You talked about, say, the Good Old Boys Network. I'd say, forget that. Worry about helping women. Have a network. And that's what I think WIFL does. People come to this conference, they meet people they've never met, they attend panels, they attend networking sessions, and they learn from that, and they may get a job. Women I've met at the conference, I've helped later. And I think it opens opportunities for them at the conference. And I think the difference with women, we tend to, when you network is another area I think women have to be better at. When you network, you meet people, but then when you meet them, you use those opportunities and you almost cash in on them. And that's what a lot of the guys do, and we don't. And
I women feel guilty helps. About yes. it. They feel like they're taking advantage.
Exactly. And that's what we have to get rid of. That's what we have to throw out the window and say, you know what? You meet somebody, you have an opportunity, you cash in on it, and it helps you, and get rid of that guilt.
I'm sort of curious how you figured that out in your career, because I didn't give your bio. I didn't announce your bio on the air, but I did read it, and that's true. You know, you really moved your way up, and you had some incredibly great spots along the way. And it didn't occur to me when I read it that you must have been networking and getting mentors from DEA. In one of the, in fact, you know, is one of the agencies has a very large male population. Mm-hmm. So how did you do it, or how did you figure out to do it?
Actually, it was just recently in this last position and dealing with WIFL, the importance of networking, even working with the silent auction that we have at WIFL to raise funds for scholarship money for women going to law enforcement careers. It wasn't until then that I realized how many contacts I had or how many people I knew, and it was just this past couple of years. And that's what I would love to, when I speak, is to tell, especially the young woman, start young.
Start young, yeah.
Start young,
yeah.
Because it will help you in your career.
Yeah. A lot of places you could have gotten to, you know, when you look back and you're like, oh, I missed that opportunity. I could have taken that. And I think women look back with a little bit more regret sometimes in their career than men. You know, because I think men are sort of grabbing onto these opportunities without sort of trepidation. I think sometimes women have trepidation about making that next move. So that, you know, that should be very interesting. And I'm sure the attendees, you know, it'll connect in their own mind about, you know, it's a statement of the obvious that we didn't really think about. So I'm sure everybody will look forward to that. And, you know, Margie, we normally by this point have told the listeners what, you know, it's a 4-day conference, and we've normally told our listeners what each day's agenda is. And I feel like we haven't done that yet.
Well, we can start.
Yeah. So it's 4 days.
It's 4 days. And I want to talk about the special training session because
That's day one.
And we're doing this now as a regular course of events for each conference. It's something perhaps that agents would never get to experience. When you talk about explosives, not many agencies connect with that because it's not within their jurisdiction. So this particular session, terrorism and the screening of improvised explosive devices.
IEDs.
And we hear about it all the time. What is an IED? Really, with the cooperation of TSA, FAMS, and ATF, have made this possible, and we're very, very grateful. You know, you mentioned this. We were at the Gaylord in Tennessee, and we were going to do it there. And
their conference was already scheduled.
Yeah,
there.
We were scheduled. Received a telephone call very shortly after the flooding, and within 3 days, we had signed a contract in Atlanta.
Yeah.
But one phone call to ATF and FAMS, and they've been fantastic in putting this and replicating this training now down in Atlanta with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation.
And that's day one.
The first day.
Yeah, day one for the WIFL conference is always training day.
Yes.
And you're at a range and you're going to deal with, I believe, live explosives.
Yes, there'll be live shots and there's a whole shot card. People who have signed up for that will see exactly the type of explosives that the Christmas Day bomber used and what damage that could have caused if, in fact, he was successful. Also, you'll look at the Richard Reed shoe bomber and those types of explosives so people will understand. And also, FAMS will also talk about the screening. And, of course, you know, some of this is classified. And
we're not going to talk about it in detail in the air, but the training, because
the training
they're all federal agents that are attending. You're all federal agents who attend. So the Air Marshal Service through Atlanta is going to be able to put that on for your conference attendees. That's very nice. Yeah. You always have a great and interesting training day. And training day is, you know, out and about. It's not inside the classroom setting.
Yeah.
So, and then you have 3 other days of workshops.
Yeah, the first day is the leadership day. The second day is the security and law enforcement day. And the third day is you and your federal career. So the leadership day, we obviously have some very good speakers, as we do on
Mary speaking
days.
That day.
Mary welcomes everybody and gives our little speech. I shouldn't say little. We have about 650 attendees.
Already?
So we have a very good lineup of folks from all the different agencies, the IGs, the federal agencies. It's just terrific.
Has registration closed?
No. Registration is open until 1 week before the conference. So we're going to shut down registration on June 12th by, you know, you can't do it anymore online, but you can certainly call in.
Or show up at the conference. You take show ups
with the government credit card in hand.
Right. So for our listeners, anyone who's interested in attending the conference, they can go on your website, wiffle.org, and there's on the homepage, there's a big peach.
Just click on the peach.
Click on the peach, and the peach represents
Peachtree Street,
which is where the
Hyatt Regency, which, by the way, everybody will be in the same hotel, which is wonderful. The training sessions are held in wonderful rooms. They're very modern, up-to-date, just terrific training rooms and exhibit halls. So we're very pleased about that. And I think people are really going to join. Speaking of networking, we're going to have a networking lunch. And Mary's going to be in charge of that. I haven't told her yet.
That's a good way to do it.
And we're actually going to make people sit with other people that you don't know. And you're forced to network. And I think that's really going to be some fun. I think people are going to have a lot of fun. We'll have some prizes, too.
650 people. It's always a great conference. You put on a great conference. We do need to take our mid-show break. And when we come back, we have a special guest who's calling in. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. When you say that you work for the federal government, many people out there immediately picture you wearing a suit, driving a government-issue sedan, and living in D.C. While that may be true for some, in reality, federal employees have a wider variety of jobs than most people could ever imagine, from postal workers to CIA agents, from working in an office to working in outer space. These jobs are all so different that it's hard to believe they have something in common, but they do. And that similarity is GEICO. As employees of the federal government, many of these people may be eligible for additional discounts on top of GEICO's already low rates. And just because the cost is lower doesn't mean that GEICO's service is anything less than top rate. So whether you're in animal control or air traffic control, call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO. Or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune into Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and I have with me today on our show the Women in Federal Law Enforcement Organization. With me in the studio is Margie Moore, their executive director, one of the founding mothers, and Mary Cooper, who is the president of the executive committee for WIFL and who's giving one of the keynote addresses at the WIFL conference in Atlanta this year, not Tennessee. It's been changed last minute. And we're going to have with us now on the radio, we're going to be able to speak with one of the speakers who's on day three of the conference. And her name is Amy Herman. And I believe Amy's joining us by phone. Hi, Amy. Yeah. Hi, Amy. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Amy, thank you so much for being with us today on Fed Talk. You're a fascinating person. And because we read about you online. And you have both your master's in art history.
Yes, I do.
And you also, I forgot, you went back to law school?
No, I went to law school first and then went back for a master's in art history.
Right. And then, and you didn't end up practicing law, did you?
I did actually for a couple of years and knew from the very beginning that was not what I was going to end up doing. Good practice, good experience, but I knew it was not for me in the long run.
And it's so interesting, Amy, that you were able eventually to sort of bring together both your background, your education in the law, along with your interest and your education and work experience in art. You're going to be one of the speakers on the Wednesday panels. And I understand that the name of your session is The Art of Perception.
That's correct.
The Art of Perception. And there's an article that I read online. And are you still at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York?
Actually, that's where I do a lot of my programs for the New York City Police Department. But my day job, I work at Public Television Channel 13 WNET here in New York.
That's right. That's right. And so I guess the article I read where you did some of your training for New York, was it New York City's Finest?
Yes, it is.
New York City's Finest was at the Museum of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in Manhattan, otherwise known to the locals as the Met.
That's
and
right.
If I understand correctly, the training you do at the Met for New York City Police is going to be very similar to what you're talking about At the Wednesday session?
That's exactly right. I'm going to give a demonstration of what it is, how I train police officers in New York City, and I've been doing it all over the country. I work with law enforcement agencies at all different levels around the country, and the presentation is, the methodology is the same. I just use different works of art depending on where I am.
And tell our listeners what goes down. It's really, it's an interesting combination of of subject matters that you would like, you know, when we go to, you know, when we go push through the public school systems or any school system in college, you don't think of these two areas of thought coming together. And there you have, there you've done it.
Well, it's really what I tell the groups that I work with. My program is very simple, but it's not easy to do. What I'm asking everyone to do is that I realized when I started doing this program that the key to our professional success is enhanced observation and perception and being able to communicate effectively. Because it doesn't matter what you see or how you perceive it if you can't communicate it correctly. So I had the idea, actually.
Why is that important to police?
It's crucial to police because so often police officers are working in exigent circumstances and they have to make decisions in a split second. Mm-hmm. So what my course tries to instill in the participants is you have a lot of visual information available to you, think carefully about what you're seeing, and be able to turn around and communicate exactly what it is you see. And think about the words that you're using. So because I've learned from working with so many law enforcement officials, small details solve crime.
Mm-hmm.
And small details solve problems. So by using art as the vehicle, everybody sees something in a painting, and I ask the participants to tell me exactly what they see in front of them so that when you apply those skills at a crime scene or you apply those skills interrogating a witness, you have a better idea of what you're observing, how you're informing your perceptions, and turning around and communicating it, whether in a courtroom, whether to witnesses or other police officers. And somehow this really simplified method of observing, perceiving, and communicating, they're skills that are important to everyone.
You know, it reminds me of, you know, in the Sunday papers, there's the Fine Waldo, or you look at the two pictures,
that's right.
And
that's
you have
right.
to circle what's alike and what's different, right?
Exactly.
Kids love those games.
So do adults.
I know, they do, but, you know, we sort of get away from it. You know,
how important it is. And I'll give you an example of something that I do. I will put a photograph up on the wall, and I will say to the participants, write one sentence about what you see. Just one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And half the people in the room will miss something that's crucial in the photograph. And it's amazing to me that we're all looking at the same image, and people see things very, very differently. So in my program, I bring the participants, I take them out of their physical environment and bring them to an art museum, and we look at paintings. That's the method we mm-hmm. use to learn to look. And people have to discuss what they see in paintings. It doesn't matter who painted the work, you know, the context. It's what do you see in front of you, and you have to present it to your colleagues. So hopefully when you're on the job mm-hmm. and you see something, you will rethink and renew your sense of inquiry, you know, how you are doing your job by thinking about how you're communicating.
Give us an example, because the article I read online about you know, a group of New York City police officers who went through one of your training days,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You showed them several different works of art.
Right.
And it was interesting. And, of course, this was the reporter sort of picking up on the pieces of what to report. But it was sort of interesting to hear what the painting was really about and how some of the viewpoints people had about what was going on in there. Sometimes they were on and they were off, you know?
Absolutely. And that's what's so interesting is as I tell the participants, they bring their personal and professional eyes to the table. So when you are looking at a painting, everybody's going to see it differently and interpret what they see based on their own experience. But what I try to do is gear them away from that and really concentrate on the objective information in front of them. One of the rules in my classes, and I don't know why law enforcement agents always break this rule.
Lawyers do too.
That's true. Lawyers do too.
I know what you're going to say.
They're not allowed to use the words obviously and clearly because those words assume that everyone's on the same page. So when someone says, well, obviously this is a case of X, it might not be obvious to me.
Right.
And, you know, when you're in a situation where you have to make judgments very, very quickly, saying that it's obviously this closes the door to further inquiry. But what about X, or why isn't it this? So when they're doing their presentations, not allowed to use those words, and everyone breaks the rule. And I catch them, and they don't realize how often they say the words.
But, you know, it's really hard to change in an instant the power of your how you perceive, how your brain, because it's really a function of your brain developed a way of doing it, and it just goes into that automatic mode. And then the other, because I read, when I was reading the article, I thought the other half of it, which the reporter didn't capture in the article, but you did when you introduced the subject just now, was communicating what you see. It's not your mind isolating what you see.
Right.
It's how you communicate it.
And I have found after doing this program for, I've been working with law enforcement since 2004, and I've been doing it with the medical profession since 2000, that communication has evolved as equally important as observation, because your observations and perceptions really aren't worth much if you can't communicate effectively and succinctly. So I have really tailored the program over the years to focus as much on effective communication. And it's very interesting to watch the participants. And you made a good point that it's hard to change the way people think. You know, we've all been doing our jobs a long time. But I analogize my program to go to the benefits of going on vacation. What I hope is you'll enjoy the benefits of vacation long after you get home. And when these participants are back on the job, I hope that they'll think back to the course and say, you know, I look at things differently. I'll give you an example. I got a call from a police department, and we were talking about having me come work with a group of detectives who were working on a cold case, 25 years, an unsolved murder. Mm. And I said to them, what do you think I can help you do? And they said, we want to renew our whole sense of questioning. Get out of the investigation. Get out of the police station. Go to the museum. Think about how we ask questions, how we formulate our answers, and hopefully it will give us new insight into the investigation.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I feel like my brain pauses whenever I read your article and I hear about it, because it's taking these two different principles, mm-hmm. art, mm-hmm. and then, well, maybe even more, in psychology. There's so many different things at play, and you take it, and it's so interesting of you sort of repackaged it in a way to help doctors and police officers. Those are different worlds.
They're very different worlds, but, you know, I'm always gratified to hear about people's applications of the program, and 2 weeks before the Times Square bomber case was successfully investigated, I had the Joint Terrorism Task Force in New York in my program. And I sent them a congratulations when they got the bomber off the plane. And I said, you know, congratulations. I'm so proud, you know, and we were talking about not just the observation and perception skills of all the people that were involved in that investigation, mm-hmm. but think about the line of communication that was crucial and could not have been broken among all the different law enforcement agencies that were instrumental in getting that guy.
Wow. That's just really interesting. And in this article I read, it talked about an example of a police officer who went back out on the job after, I think it was after he took your course,
mm-hmm.
and he was plainclothes in Times Square,
right.
and he was communicating, I guess this was before the bomber, and
mm-hmm.
He was communicating, I guess through his earpieces, with other undercovers all over Times Square, and he was going to explain, you know, some sort of potential suspect that he saw
right.
looking into parked cars, probably to evaluate whether or not there was anything in there to steal. And the distinction between describing this potential suspect as an individual, a male wearing all black,
right.
or dressed in all black, I think it was dressed in all black, versus a male with a black wool cap, because that all of a sudden is a very important distinguishing factor. Black
it's a
cap,
different visual picture.
Yeah, black cap, and there was something else, a furry collar or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what struck me was, why does it take a course like yours to have a, you know, sort of the, it isn't, why isn't that intuitive to police work?
I think it is. I have found police officers to be some of the sharpest observers I have ever worked with. But I think that police officers are victims of the rest of us. We've been doing something for so long that we forget to keep those skills really, really sharp. We have it in there. I mean, I'll put a painting up and I'll say, well, how many of you see the fire in the corner there? Yet no one mentioned it. That everybody sees it, but this course, I think one of the purposes of my course is to refresh people's idea of what they're looking at and make that connection, that crucial nexus between seeing something and being able to articulate it. It's in there, I'm just reminding them. And I also find the course reminds people the difference between subjective and objective information.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so important when you're solving crimes, when you're doing investigations, when you're talking to people, what's subjective and what's really confirmable data. So my course, in a sense, is a review for what you term to be intuitive information,
mm-hmm.
and bringing it to the fore and reminding all these people that they have these skills, but they need to use them every single day at work.
And you know, it's interesting, my last point I'm going to make to you, because I would never have the opportunity to speak to you, is, you know, as a lawyer, a practicing lawyer representing individuals, I do have the opportunity to, you know, in being in a litigating process,
uh-huh.
to have a different observation of a set of facts than my adversary, usually the federal government,
right.
usually federal law enforcement. And when I prepare clients to be interviewed by an investigative body, like, you know, a federal law enforcement agency,
mm-hmm.
I always say to them, you know, be careful about answering questions and describing a set of facts of what happened.
That's right.
Because your version of what happened could be very different. It could be very different from, you know, my version. I always say, you know, usually to a male, I'll say it to a male client, you probably mm-hmm. like football. I've never watched a game in my life. Okay. If we both went to a Redskins game and sat at the 50-yard line,
right,
you and I would have very different views of what happened.
That's right.
Very different.
That's absolutely right.
And it's always, that moment is always, you see the light bulb go off.
That how different your perceptions really are.
Yeah.
And to that point, and then I know you have to go, I just remind all the participants that your observations and perceptions of the situation are informed by your five senses. It's not just about seeing. It's smelling and hearing and taking in an entire scene, because that's really what informs our perceptions, and that's why the course is called The Art of Perception. Art as a pun, because we
yeah.
use visual arts, but also it's the perceptions that you, that are informed by your five senses. So I'm really, in the class, I'm telling people to turn up the volume on all their observations and to rethink how they communicate what they're seeing.
It's really interesting. I'm really glad we were able to have you on as our guest.
Thank you for having me.
The article. Keep up the good work. Best of luck to you at the WIFL Conference. Thank you, Amy Herman.
I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take our final break and hear a word from our sponsor, GEICO. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. By now, you've no doubt seen those car insurance commercials with the talking gecko on TV. He's always talking about how people could save 15% or more switching to GEICO. Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal in and of itself. But get this, if you're an employee of the federal government, you may be eligible to save even more than that. That's something the Gecko didn't mention in all those commercials. And you've probably heard many times about how many people have switched to Geico. Millions. But what you might not know is how many people stay with Geico once they've switched. In fact, on average, Geico customers who are federal employees have stayed with the company for over 20 years. Now that's customer satisfaction. Sound like a good deal to you? Then just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. We're in the last segment of our show with the women in federal law enforcement. They're here for their annual show to promote their conference, which is being held in Atlanta this year, June 21st through the 24th. You can go on WIFL's website to learn more about the conference and sign up. We have with us today Margie Moore, who's the executive director of WIFL, and Mary Cooper, who's the president of the executive committee. Mary's also, I believe, hosting a panel on day three, the Law Enforcement and Security Day, and it's a panel which I don't want to say it's timely, it's almost driving a huge part of our national news, And so I thought our listeners would be very interested to hear about what your panel's about and the guests you're going to have there.
We're going to be, we have two, our special agents in charge from Atlanta and Phoenix are going to be talking about Mexican drug cartel violence and how it impacts the United States. I think is what interesting, you have two cities, one close to the border, and you have a city like Atlanta who has completely been transformed because of the violence of the Mexican cartels. How we equated to how Miami was in the 80s.
Right.
And now Atlanta is the hub, and how they're going to talk about how it's affected the city, the people, and how they're dealing with it.
Give us a little insight into what kind of information they might be able to share with your conference attendees, because I still hold that belief or stereotype that when you think of the drug cartels and which sort of American cities are their initial inroad into the United States, you know, you think about the big ones along the border, Juarez being one of them, where there's a horrific right. amount down in Texas, a horrific amount of violence, but you always think of Miami. And it shifted slightly north, hasn't it, in the last 20 years?
It has. Atlanta is a huge hub. I mean, Atlanta is, when we bring a lot of reporters down there, they are shocked as to the organizations we have that are entrenched there, the violence that is happening, and how the whole city is affected by it.
And you're with DEA. How do they account for the shift? How did it end up in, it's not just Atlanta, it's also North Carolina?
It's North Carolina. It depends on, the organizations always adapt to different trends, different opportunities. And I think they saw that they had several, they set up, they were in New York, they were prominent for years. They set up in new areas for new opportunities.
Usually because law enforcement cracks down in that area and they've moved to another area of the country.
Correct.
And so on your panel, you're going to be, that panel's the third day, the Law Enforcement and Security Day, Mexican drug cartel violence impacting the U.S. And you have on the panel several people. They're all DEA, right?
Yes, they are.
And why would other women in other federal law enforcement agencies outside of DEA, why would this be of interest to them in their career, in their work?
I think it is because I think the violence affects the city and the agencies differently than you would realize. I mean, even the city of Phoenix basically has to shut down certain things that they're doing just to almost keep themselves alive because of what the violence is doing.
Yeah, and of course, there's overlapping jurisdictions amongst
yes.
federal law enforcement. So usually, you know, if there's drug activity, cartel activity, then there's usually gun running. And that's ATF, right?
Correct. And it's lessons learned, things that have happened that maybe they that provoke certain things. So if you have people in the audience that maybe in a future leadership position later, they can learn from the lessons from these two people.
Yeah, I think our listeners probably just found out that Atlanta was the new hub. And of course, there's also all the violence along the international southern border. And that's day three. Margie, there's some other really interesting topics scattered throughout your agenda. Any others that you want to hit upon?
Yes, the trafficking in the U.S., the American story, the film Playground that was produced and written by Libby Spears. WIFL, during the fall, we do a human trafficking seminar, and I had this film shown at the trafficking seminar at the Swiss Embassy. What a lot of people don't know in this country, we hear so much about human trafficking and the international aspect of people coming into this country.
Being brought in to be exploited.
But there are so many tens of thousands of children being trafficked here in the U.S., moving amongst the cities. And coincidentally, Atlanta is one of the hubs. And this film that you're going to see, it's very coincidental. And it's so horrific about what takes place when people travel into Atlanta and they want to, you know, be sexually active with children, and how the phone calls they make and then what shows up at a hotel. This is a very powerful film, but it drives home the fact, and this is what we want to bring to all the federal law enforcement people there. Be aware of what's going on in this country. We've heard so much about human trafficking, but this is American children being trafficked and the horrific deeds that are being done.
Yeah.
And the lack of services to help these folks, these kids, when they want to come out of that. There's an article today, front page of the Washington Post, just about this very factor in D.C. and the human trafficking of American girls and how this one woman has done so much to help people rescue them and get out of this.
And you're going to have, I believe, Libby Spears, who's the producer of the film.
She testified about in 3 months ago about this very problem before the Judiciary Committee. And she's just fantastic because she single-handedly has taken on this issue and has corralled a lot of people to become more involved. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they're a big partner in this. They play a major role. And we're very pleased that we have Nancy McBride, who will be with us from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So it's going to be showing the film, educate everybody, and then we're going to have a discussion following. And both Libby will be there and Nancy McBride. So I think it's a great opportunity for the federal agencies to educate themselves about what's going on.
Yeah. It's always these topics are so disturbing, you know, when the criminal element's exploiting sort of the weaker or indefensible elements of society. Mm-hmm. It's very disturbing. And last year, I recall that you had the international human trafficking was a big part of your agenda.
Yes. Wiffle, we do want to focus on crimes of violence against women. You know, that's part of our awards program, too, when we give out awards. It's so important that women stay close to other women and help each other out. I think that's what Mary was talking about. But also stay close to the issues that affect women, mm-hmm. whether they be victims, you know, or women in law enforcement. We just need to be more sensitive to the issues that really affect. And violence against women is a major mm-hmm. topic in this country.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, here I am promoting another show. But 60 Minutes, mm-hmm. just a couple of weeks ago, had spotlighted Senator or Secretary Clinton. And it was very interesting because, you know, people knew about this when she was first lady. She was very focused on international women's issues, things that practices and societal cultures in other parts of the world that exploited women. And it's always been a very important part of her agenda. And I was very pleased to see 60 Minutes give it some airtime, that even as Secretary of State, she sort of taken it to that next level and made it a huge part of what she does on the international scene. Because we've had FBI on our show talking about a lot of the cyber crime, and it's usually through human trafficking designed to exploit women, and so they're very on top of this issue too. But I guess I was surprised to see the topic domestically. You always hear about it internationally.
Yes, domestically.
So we have about a minute left. There is an awards.
Yes, we do present awards each year. The Julie White Cross Award for heroism, bravery, above and beyond the call of duty, the outstanding federal law enforcement employee, the outstanding advocate for women in federal law enforcement. Mary Cooper is receiving an award from the executive committee.
Did you know that, Mary?
Yeah, for our outstanding work and contributions to WIFL in helping raise money for scholarships. And we'll be giving out public service awards. And it's a very festive evening and just one not to be missed. And it's just a celebration of the contributions of women.
And Julie E. Cross, tell our listeners, Julie White Cross, it's an award in her name.
Yes, she was the first federal agent woman killed in the line of duty 30 years ago in 1980. And Secret Service just recently awarded her brother, who's the survivor in the family, with the Medal of Valor from the Secret Service. So it's a name that we want to keep in the forefront to let people know, yes, we celebrate contributions, but it's a very dangerous job and the issue of safety and the need to be secure.
Yeah. And then the last day, very quickly in our last minute here, Margie, your last day is you and your federal career. You always have somebody there to talk about the TSP. Everybody wants to know about the TSP.
Yes.
Long-term care.
What is new is Dr. Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, who really will be talking to women about taking care of oneself, the responders being the caretakers, but now all of this trauma that you experience, how do you take care of yourself?
Margie, always put on a great conference. I hope our listeners will click onto your website, consider going. Thank you again for being on. Mary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Deborah.